It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 95, A Place in the Sun. A Place in the Sun is a 1951 film directed by George Stevens, starring Montgomery Clift, Elizabeth Taylor, and Shelley Winters. And it is a big old drama. It is pretty to look at, but we'll see how our panel comes down on this film, which is a version of a much older work of art that we will talk about. But let me introduce the panel to you first. Welcome back, Randy Dittinga. Hi.
I've just got to say, Shelley Winters, stay away from the water, would you? I mean, first there's this movie, and then you go marry Robert Mitchum and hang out by a lake. And then 20 years later, you're taking a cruise on New Year's Day on the Poseidon. I mean, just don't even go near anything wet. And Shelley Brisbane, same goes for you. Just don't even drink water. Don't drink water. Don't look
Poor choices, Shelley. Poor choices.
Save yourself, Shelleys.
Well, the episode has a title. We can stop right now. Next up, it's Mickey Maynard. Hi.
Hi. I'm deciding between my wardrobe of strapless dresses with giant tulle skirts, which ones I'm wearing to this taping.
That was a thing in the 50s prom dress pantheon. We'll talk about that, too. Nathan Alderman, hello.
Hello. This is a 1950s news bulletin saying, remember, this weekend, if you're out on a large body of water, don't drown your troublesome girlfriend. I repeat, don't drown your troublesome girlfriend.
Too soon.
It's been a public service announcement. Yeah, Shelley Winters does have trouble with bodies of water, it seems, in Poor Choices, but... Yeah, so this movie is, we'll start out with the history, I suppose, just a little bit, and then I'll ask about everyone's sort of history of their own with it. This movie is a version of the Theodore Dreiser story, An American Tragedy, which came out in 1925. There was a play. There was a movie in 1931 called An American Tragedy. This movie came out in 1951 and is based on, there are some differences, which I'm sure we'll get into. I don't have a lot of the details from the book, but I understand one of our panelists has read it, so we'll go there a little bit. But there were controversies attached to all different dramatizations of this work, which is also interesting to get in to, given the time periods 1931 and 1951 for the films. And this, though, was also a very prestigious and successful film. It won George Stevens an Oscar for directing, and a lot of the performances are praised. So it's definitely a big picture in all the ways that movies in the 1950s could be. And Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift are at their prettiest. So that's where we begin. Let me ask each of you, though, whether you have seen this film before and what your background with it is. Mickey, I'm sure you have at some point seen A Place in the Sun, right?
Yes, actually, we read the book, An American Tragedy, in my 20th century American literature class in college. So I already knew the story. And I believe I saw the movie for the first time on TCM. So not, you know, I probably read the book. And a few years later, watched the movie because I was curious about what they'd done with it, essentially.
It's always fun to find out what they've done to this book, whether you like the book or not. Nathan, how about you? Is this the first time for you, or have you seen it before?
This is my first time seeing the movie. It's my first Montgomery Clift movie, I believe. It might even be my first Elizabeth Taylor movie. I really liked it. I thought it was very well directed, kind of ahead of its time. And, you know, I can't say no to a surprise Raymond Burr.
Oh, yeah, we have Raymond Burr content for later as well. I love random trivia. And it even goes back to the 1931 version. I was so proud of myself when I found that Raymond Burr trivia that goes back to 1931. You'll just have to wait for it. How about you, Randy? Had you seen this before?
Yeah, I've seen it before. I think it's a fantastic movie, even though I think things kind of go downhill as soon as Raymond Burr shows up.
You take that back. Nothing can ever go downhill when Raymond Burr shows up, except maybe the American recut of Godzilla.
But it's such a just a captivating movie. It's just so well paced. I never, until Raymond shows up, I never felt for a second distracted. I was just pulled into everything. And I've gone on a little bit of a wormhole the last couple of years. I'm a journalist, and I want to write something about a historic true crime and the crime behind this, the initial true life crime from, I think, the 1900s, the 1900s. Is really fascinating, and there's been quite a lot written about it. And there's a lot of differences between the real crime and the book and the movie and the other movie, which we'll talk about. That was a play, so there's just a lot of it's a tangled web. But it's just the whole movie. I think there's so much about the backstory that's fascinating too. It just hits all of my film erogenous zones. You know, it's got a great backstory, and it's really fun to watch, and it's really sexy. So yeah, I'm a big fan of this.
It's interesting because some of the knocks on this movie are about the pacing, and there are weird comparisons between this movie and the other movie, which being made in 1931 means they're very different styles, and we'll get there. But I just want to say now that I think it's an interesting argument to be made. I feel like this movie is seen differently by different people. There's some people who just find it to be a masterpiece. It's on the top of a lot of, you know, top movies of all time list, maybe not at the very top, but somewhere in the top five or the top 10. And then for other people, it's a bore, or it's a melodrama, or it is slow paced. So I don't know what makes the movie hit so differently for different people. I didn't read anything or talk to anybody who said they hated it, but even I think most reviewers were positive on it, especially in the filmmaking aspects of it. But there are some people who seem to be bothered by parts of it. And we can unpack that if that applies to any of you.
Yeah, it does to me. I mean, I was reading a lot about the movie in preparation for our podcast, and people were saying, you know, it's one of the four great American movies, and it's one of the top 10 and top 100 movies. And, you know, I definitely see why they would think that. But for me personally, I felt the performances were better than the movie as a whole. And the movie is laden with so much 50s morality. And also, it's another movie where World War II has just happened, and we get no flicks at World War II at all. It's just as if, you know, it's sort of a little bit like Dodsworth, where the Depression has happened. There's no flick at that. It feels like the original book, which was set in the 20s. And you know, sort of like world affairs never happen in this world.
It's kind of like thinking about a lot of the art being created now, like the pandemic never happened. It just kind of erased from our past in our current. And it were like, what, you know, 5 years, four years past it, just like this movie was like 4 or 5 years past World War II. But then it's not really, even like you said, even kind of flicked at.
Yeah, I feel like this is a really well-made movie. It's tremendously well-directed in ways that feel really ahead of its time. And I think it's really well-acted, too. I think it's kind of poorly written. I mean, aside from the fact that based on an American tragedy kind of ruins the suspense of the film, the central relationship relies entirely on the direction and the acting, because story-wise, it does not make sense. You can kind of see how Montgomery Clift's character would be obsessed with Elizabeth Taylor, but there is no in-story reason why, aside from the fact that Montgomery Clift looks like Montgomery Clift, why Elizabeth Taylor would be like, wait, you've got incredible mommy issues and I've known you for 5 minutes? I'm all in.
Right, and then the whole issue with Shelley Winters, the other Shelley. He's been told the first day of work, we do not fraternize with employees. And the first thing he does is fraternize with an employee. And in the book, it's very well explained that he's lonely, that he's not accepted by his uncle and their social set. And he's a supervisor, so he really is not supposed to be mixing with, you know, the pink collar workers in the factory. But he doesn't really have any friends, and he doesn't have anybody to hang out with. And so in the book, we get the whole point of the relationship. In the movie, I'm lacking the scene that explains the chemistry between them.
Yeah, he's a supervisor in the earlier movie as well. So, and in fact, it reads different. It reads creepier in the previous movie. It reads like, yeah, you shouldn't be fraternizing with her because you're her boss.
Well, and in the previous movie, she says that. They go canoeing on Lake Arrowhead, which is what it's supposed to be in real life. And she basically says, I'm not supposed to go canoeing with you. And in this case, she seems to be very happy to have his attention and then gets a little psycho about his attention.
I think, too, that the way A Place in the Sun wants to deal with that is that they connect outside of work. You know, they see each other at the movie, but they clearly know each other from work. They work in the same department. And he's, you know, he has this job, which they are at pains to point out, you know, he's the poor relation. And so he gets a job in a department that is entirely staffed by women, and he's not the supervisor. And I assume that that is part of, you know, bringing him down a few pegs, as well as, you know, making there not be a specific supervisory issue with the Shelley Winters character, but still they say no fraternization. I just wanted to really quickly say about the World War II thing. As Randy mentioned, the original crime that this is based on happens in like 1905, 1906. Yeah. Then the drama, you know, Dreiser wrote his novel in 25. It sometimes seems like when something is adapted that is from older material, that they feel like they need to bring it into the modern era so that it doesn't become a period piece. And I sort of get that, because there's no reason it has to be in 1920 or 1905. But when they do that, they sometimes forget to bring the modern world along into their movie as well. Because, yeah, he would have, George probably would have been in the war. Maybe the factory that they work in would have had something to do with the war in some way, or that community would have been affected. But I think it becomes shorthand for them to just say, you know what, let's just
skip it.
Maybe we're tired of war. Let's just skip it. Yeah. And I wonder too about the screenplay. Yeah, I don't have strong feelings about the writing, but it does seem like the people whose names are on it are kind of journeymen. And based on some reading I did, apparently George Stevens got in, especially with the romantic scenes between Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift, and did a lot of, you know, writing, ad hoc writing for the next day, and would like hand them pages and say, here, this is the love scene that you're going to do. And that's probably not a good sign unless you have a director that is also a writer. But even in that case, that's kind of a lot to carry to hopefully make your movie work in the end, as opposed to saying, well, I just want the scene to work out this particular way. That doesn't seem like it's a formula for good writing.
I mean, I believe Montgomery Clift's loneliness, he radiates alienation and discomfort in this movie. I don't know if this is before or after his infamous car accident.
It's before.
I'm guessing
it's
after. Long,
it's before. It's like 5 years before.
Interesting, because when there's a scene where he's turned toward Elizabeth Taylor and they're kind of canoodling in her car after he's fallen asleep, and you can see what looks like a very clear scar along his jaw.
Oh, I could talk about that. I know about that. I went on a little Montgomery Clift wormhole. That's actually a documentary that came out about 4 or 5 years ago by his nephew, who's a young guy. And it was about a lot of kind of the mythology around him and how some biographers have been really unfair to Montgomery Clift. But while I was down that wormhole, it turned out the scar is on his his right? I guess it must be the right part of his neck, his right, and I guess our left, looking at him on the screen when he's looking at us. And it was some kid tried to drown him in a pool when he was very young, and it popped some sort of gland in his neck, and he had to have a surgery to repair this gland, and that's where that scar comes from. And he had the accident that caused half of his face to just not move very well when he had plastic surgery. That was the famous accident where I think he was leaving a party at Liz Taylor's house and might have had a little too much to drink and crashed, and Liz Taylor came down and helped him open his airway or open his mouth or something so he could breathe. So that's a little bit of Montgomery Clift medical history for you.
Yeah, this is, like I say, right while they were making Raintree County, And he was leaving a party at Elizabeth Taylor's house, and he was, it was such a go, like he could have died, and like his eye kind of came out and stuff. It was bad. And I think one of the issues too, in addition to his face being fairly immobile after the plastic surgery, was that he was already an alcoholic, but became addicted to pain medication and just was very, very different than he had been before. And so if you watch movies, Raintree County Forward, he's very twitchy and even more sort of tremulous than he is in, you know, these earlier movies where, I mean, he was always a broody kind of performer. He was a New York actor and of the method school, and he comes out to the movies and he's not really a fan of being a part of the whole movie colony, but the movie star thing. But, you know, you give somebody a lot of money and give them an opportunity and they're going to try it. But, you know, once that accident happened, he lived for another 10 years, but it was very, it was a very, very different life. You know, you watch him in something like Suddenly Last Summer, which is not a very good movie, but the reason to watch it, which is with him and Elizabeth Taylor happened to both be in that movie, but he's playing this psychiatrist and there's no reason in the world for him to be as sort of timorous and twitchy as he is in that movie. But that is who Montgomery Clift was by 1958.
He's fascinating. He kind of looks like you crossed James Dean and Marlon Brando in a lab. And he's the result. He's really interesting to look at, and he's definitely of that, like James Dean, Marlon Brando, like clench your fist and just act so hard school, but he does a good job with it. You feel like the discomfort coming off of him in waves, and it's so effective for the character and for the movie.
A really interesting performance to just see the contrast between that style of acting and somebody totally different is his first movie, Red River, where he is with John Wayne. And that'll just mess with your head.
John Wayne
just
is like,
watch Red River.
He's kind of like Vin Diesel. He's both simultaneously a terrific actor and a terrible actor sometimes at the same time. I love him for that. He's not for nothing else. He's a terrible person, but I love him for that.
I just wanted to mention toward the beginning of the movie, we see him come in when the Eastmans, and I kept thinking they were going to be in photography, but they ended up making women's bathing suits. But he comes into the Eastman drawing room where they're all hanging out, and the younger Eastman is there, and he's standing, and the way it's photographed is that the Eastmans are very big, and Montgomery Clift is very small. In the doorway, he just looks little as he walks in and tries to awkwardly talk to them, and they're suspicious of him, or they're suspicious, and they're talking about his mother and how strange she is, and so on. And then a few scenes later, he is really showing some game in the movie theater with Shelley Winters. And I was surprised by that. I kind of wish there had been some kind of a little more development, because I'm like, here he's kind of very kind of bashful and uncomfortable, but then with her, he's got it going on. He has that like really sly thing with slipping into her apartment to turn down the radio.
I think that thing at the beginning is a filmmaking device as much as anything. And he knows where he stands probably with these people. I mean, he's met the uncle somewhere distant, and the uncle has seen him as a bellhop, as a serving class person. And he said, come on down and I'll help you out. But Montgomery Clift, I don't think, would know whether that was a serious offer, but he's ambitious and he wants to come down there and see how they're going to treat him. And he probably gets the vibe that he's a poor relation.
Well, I just want to throw in an obligatory Downton Abbey reference, because there he is in his tweed suit and everyone else is in evening clothes. Wow. And there is a scene at the dinner table in Downton Abbey where Tom and Sybil come from Ireland. And the only suit that Tom has is a tweed suit and everyone else is in dinner clothes. So it's clear that tweed stands for, you know, working class, apparently, and evening clothes. Boy, did they dress up for some mythical town and the 50s. I thought that was absolutely, you know, amazing how dressed up they all were. But I want to just reference back to that shot where he's coming down the hall and the door seems forever away and he's walking in and it's taking forever. And then a few scenes later, Elizabeth Taylor arrives and she comes in the door, but she's not small at all. She's filling that hallway as she comes in to say good evening to everyone because she clearly belongs, and that's her crowd, and they're running off in her convertible.
I was watching carefully throughout the film, and you can see how Stevens visually shows George's increasing acceptance with the in crowd. Mm-hmm. Little by little, more and more people greet him. He glides into the room more easily. He's less alone. People are saying hello to him. It's a very clever progression. And my favorite moment of that narrative arc is after he's been arrested, in the scene where Elizabeth Taylor's family is discussing what they're going to do about this, you have, I think it's one of his, like his cousin in the foreground on the phone talking to the family lawyer about how they're going to spin this as like, we barely knew him. We barely met him. And it's just an aside that this, as the camera tracks past to get to what's really going on in the scene, but it's so chilling and so perfect. And I love it. I mean, really, when you think about it, the villains in this film are rich people who refuse to share their wealth and power with others, and a woman's inability to get access to reproductive health care.
I did want to mention, since we're mentioning the convertible, I didn't notice this in the movie, but I read something about this. In the first scene where Montgomery Clift is hitchhiking, there is a white convertible that just blows past him and waves at him, and that's Liz Taylor.
That's Angela Vickers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't notice that. That's so cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, and all these cars are blowing by, and then he gets picked up by this kind of Okie from Muskogee looking person. But I was going to just say about the clothes, you know, because I think the clothes in this movie are pretty fabulous. He starts with a tweed suit. He ends up in a dark suit for the very famous Tell Mama All scene. And then he ends up in evening clothes. And then he ends up in jail.
Costumes by Edith Head, yeah. Particularly the Liz Taylor dresses that we were referencing. We have the black one and the white one. It is absolutely an indication that costumes are meant to tell part of the story, as well as say, hi, if Elizabeth Taylor wasn't pretty enough, please look at this dress, these dresses. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I thought what Randy was saying about how he has game with Shelley Winters and their relationship. I think both of the relationships are credible in their own right that Montgomery Clift has. And I think that's both good acting from Montgomery Clift, but I think it's also a super interesting commentary from the director even, and from the George character, because so often, in fact, almost always, movies tell you what couple you're supposed to root for or who we're attached to. You may have a love triangle, but there's obviously a weak link in that love triangle, and we need to look over here. And I feel like why ever he ends up feeling the way he does about Shelley Winters, whether, you know, ambition or whether he had met Liz Taylor or whether he's a gold digger or whatever it is, the relationship by itself with Shelley Winters is credible. He is lonely, he's horny, and he cares about her to the extent that he can at that moment in the movie. In the earlier American Tragedy movie, it feels a little more transactional, as Mickey was mentioning, that they're basically sitting in the boat, and she's, I'm not supposed to hang out with you, but you will, won't you? And there are a couple of other things that he says in the movie that I can't quote that are extremely transactional, which is so funny because, you know, we're in this pre-code era where you can't say certain things, but you can imply them very heavily. And sometimes that is more direct than what we can do in the 1950s. So I appreciate the way they draw the relationship between him and Shelley Winters, which I think makes it even more striking when he's beginning to fall for Elizabeth Taylor. Like every time he sees her, he's like, oh my. And it's both a relationship of, you know, lust and love, and also a financially beneficial one to him. But the movie doesn't say, okay, the Shelley Winters relationship never existed. He has to deal with it, and he deals with it in a way that is not good. But you believe that while he was having the relationship, it was meaningful on some level to him.
I like the shot of the radio standing in for a fire or crashing waves.
Then, or a hand or a leg or something, as they used to do in the very early 30s, where you'd see a leg with a bare foot. And it would be like, oh, my God.
And then it turns to static by the morning because nothing is on the air.
Because it goes off the air, yeah.
Radio stations don't play all night in the 1950s, and everybody would have known that.
And then you hear the rooster. So that's your signal that he spent the night.
It was quite, the whole movie, we haven't even gotten to the abortion stuff yet. I thought it was quite, I mean, they got away with a lot without ever saying, you know, without ever mentioning abortion and those kinds of things. I'm a really big fan of Shelley Winter's performance in here. There's a DVD that has a commentary. It's about 25 years old, apparently, by George Stevens Jr. and the screenwriter, Ivan Moffat, and they were talking about how I think she was, they were trying to consider whether to hire her or who to hire to play the Shelley Winters role, and she really drabbed herself up. I think it was maybe in the cafeteria, and trying to be as unnoticeable as possible, even though she was at the time a really big bombshell. That's what they were, Hollywood was making her out to be, this kind of va-voom hot actress. And she got the part because she was able to kind of tone down her beauty. And they talked about in the commentary about how, as they filmed the movie, she's an actress and she sometimes would forget, and she would try to glam herself up, and the makeup had to tone her down and get her back to the character that she's supposed to be.
The version of that story that I heard was, or that I read, was that she really wanted this part and that she got in touch with George Stevens. Yeah, and you're right. She was an major actress by then. People knew who she was. She was doing some bombshell stuff, and I think she was already starting on this tragic, you know, woman who may not get out of the movie.
Yeah,
part.
She did a lot of Gatsby, which hasn't been seen a whole lot, but she was in there, I think a year or two earlier, and she played, I forget her name, the character that gets run over.
The floozy.
Yes.
Yeah, the floozy. So she supposedly gets in touch with George Stevens, and they're going to meet at some hotel in a lobby, and she drubs herself down. She wears, you know, not much makeup or not very good makeup, and she dresses in a very plain way, and she sits in the corner of the lobby, and George Stevens comes in, and he doesn't even know. He's looking around for her, and he's looking around for her, and he can't find her, and finally he's ready to leave. He's just like, all right, she didn't show up, whatever, I'm going to go. And so he gets up, and then he looks over in the corner, and there's this plain-looking woman, and he recognizes that it's Shelley Winters. And so they had their meeting, and that was one thing that turned a light bulb on for him and let him give her the part. And what I read about her glamming herself up during the course of the movie was she had a little bit of jealousy over Elizabeth Taylor, and she's like, look, I get that I'm not supposed to be the pretty one, but does Elizabeth Taylor have to be quite that pretty? And so she would sort of try to make herself up a little bit in a bit of a competitive way. I can see that. But it's so interesting that she, and I actually have blown a few people's minds. There are pictures of Shelley Winters as sort of a pinup in the late 40s. And you show them that picture, and then you say, that's the woman who went on to, you know, not make it out alive of many movies in the 50s, 60s, and even the 70s. As you say, she has a bad reaction to Bodies of Water, and in many other cases doesn't make it out of the movie.
But poor Shelley Winters, the Washington Generals of love interests.
But I like her performance a lot. I feel like it's subdued in the right places, and it's hysterical in the right places, like at the point where she's about to lose it, when she is about to drown. There's a really interesting, I think this scene is so well directed, because there's a really interesting line between, you know, she's basically saying, come on, George, what about it? What about it? Let's get married. We're going to have a great, and he's obviously really agitated. He's decided he's not going to kill her, but she's still kind of driving him nuts. And so the movie is really smart about not forcing us to have sympathy with one character versus the other, which is a weird thing to say because George Eastman is a killer. But I enjoy watching both characters, and I think the performances are really good. And she is, as I say, in the parts where she needs to be sympathetic, she is. And the parts where she obviously deserves to continue living her life, but in the parts where she is meant to be kind of driving George crazy and helping him see the contrast between her and Elizabeth Taylor, she's doing that just right, but she's not doing too much of it.
In the commentary, George Stevens Jr. talks about the scene where Shelley's talking to the doctor who might be able to provide an abortion. And George Stevens Jr. said his father had a theory that if the performer on the screen is feeling sorry for themselves, there's nothing for the audience to do. And so you don't want to have Shelley crying. And they did several takes of that scene, and every time Shelley Winters cries, and it's not giving George Stevens what he wants. So finally he says, okay, we're going to do the last take, and we're just going to film it up until you start crying. And as an actress, she's like, I want this scene to last as long as possible, so I'm on, you know, on screen. So she extends as long as she can, trying not to cry. And that's how he gets that scene out of her, which is what he wanted, a woman desperately trying not to cry.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that she's asking him for an abortion. And she says, you know, I'm in trouble, real trouble. And it's pretty explicit for the night.
It's 1950. Excruciating. It's excruciating to watch. It's so... You and just so captivating, you're just kind of on the edge. Do we think this doctor does do abortions? But
oh yeah,
well yeah,
just
that's
for the
how
right,
she
the
got
right
there.
Sort of
yeah.
girl.
So why not her? I was thinking, why not her? But I've written about abortion in the 100 years ago in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and there was oftentimes a prejudice among abortion doctors about what kind of woman came in for an abortion. If they were married, they were considered more respectable and more worthy of having an abortion rather than somebody who was single. And I wondered if that may have been the situation here, is that the doctor maybe would have done an abortion if she'd been married, but she isn't, so he feels morally superior and doesn't
well
want to do
and
it.
I also think she could have bought an abortion. I mean, there's a scene in Downton Abbey again in the 1920s where Lady Edith goes to get an abortion, and they were about to give her an abortion and she chickened out. And then if you fast forward to Mad Men, there's a scene where Joan gets pregnant by Roger and she's going to go have an abortion and she changes her mind, you know. So I think that if you were able to pay for an abortion, or, you know, slip the envelope under the desk or whatever, that you could get an abortion. I think he sizes her up and she's telling all these lies and he's like, nah, I'm just not going to deal with this. And she doesn't have an envelope to slip me. So you're just going to have to deal with it.
And his way of dealing with it is to moralize at her, you know, which is like, okay, I'm going to turn you down. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to tell you to just go deal with it. And I wondered, because George is out in the car, I wondered if that was the thing. Does the doctor for some reason want the man in there who is going to pay for it or not? I don't know what the dynamics of that would have been at that time.
If Angela Vickers had come in, he would have absolutely agreed, because she's a nice girl from the right sort of family, and we wouldn't want to give her any scandal.
You could blackmail her forever.
Yeah, but this poor girl with nothing, he's going to moralize at her. I was going to say, I really like Shelley Winter's performance in this movie. I think it's really effective and affecting, but I feel like the movie makes a mistake in that final scene in the boat. I mean, I love the tiny glitter in the black hollow of Montgomery Clift's eye from the reflected light from the lake. That glitter of evil is bone chilling. But Shelley Winters, just they make her lay on the patheticness so thickly that you're just, by the end of that scene, you're just like, give me the oar, George, I'll do it myself.
I feel like that's to make, because this movie is so much focused on his journey, his dilemma, his whatever terrible things he might do. It's the movie is about George. And so whether we're sympathizing with him or whether we're just living inside his head, right, that's the way I felt too. I felt like, wait, why am I so upset that this, you know, this murder victim won't shut up? I mean, I felt kind of weird about that, but that's how I felt.
Well, I think because we've all been entranced by Elizabeth Taylor, and they're clearly a couple, you know, they're the Travis and Taylor of the 1951, and you want them to end up together and go off and have beautiful children, you know. And so here's Shelley Winters, who's in the way and has been whiny. And you're kind of like, okay, you know, take a swim.
So in that analogy, she'd be like, what, Pete Davidson?
Something like that. I mean, I guess so here was my issue with her performance. I wanted more exposition of the attraction that they had for each other. And then everything we get after that is whiny, whiny, whiny. And I wanted there to be something that said, you know, she's a really sweet girl. She's pretty or pretty-ish. And he needs to do the right thing. I mean, so what if Angela's gorgeous? He's gotten her pregnant. He needs to do the right thing. And I'm never convinced as a viewer that I want him to do the right thing.
No, this movie has that. That's the other thing I didn't like about it. This movie has that creepy thing from the 1950s where women are basically prizes that a man deserves and is entitled to. And it just, like I said, the performances are great. The directing is great. But the writing and the story really rubbed me the wrong way. George is such a creep. He's such a terrible, terrible person. Even though you feel for him, he's awful. And the only sympathy you get for him comes from Montgomery Clift's really good acting.
But I thought that the George character, that he's much less of a cad than he was portrayed in the book. And I think Know more in the previous movie, wasn't he portrayed much more of a cad in that film?
Yes. It's much more explicit. It also doesn't help that in that movie, the best performances are definitely by the women. Phillips Holmes is pretty wooden. He's no John Lund, but he's not that good either. And you have Sylvia Sidney in the Shelley Winters role, who, it's funny, when you IMDb Sylvia Sidney, the movies that she is most known for, according to IMDb, are Mars Attacks and Beetlejuice, which she made very late in her career. And I'm like, but what about Fury? And what about New York Street Scene or stuff like that? Right. Anyway, she's a very sympathetic, somewhat pathetic, but with reason, a character who's dealing with Phillips Holmes, who's this out and out cad. And then you have Frances D kind of being who was mostly known today for being married to Joel McRae for like 50 years.
Hey, she was in I Walked with a Zombie.
That's true. She was. She was also a film actress in the early 30s and did she was in the early version, the Katharine Hepburn version of Little Women. But she's the Angela character, and she's playing Angela much more as a spoiled hoity-toity rich girl. It kind of works in the movie, but the lines are very different in that movie than in this movie.
Well, the other thing about the book, I was just going to say about the book and the previous movie, is that there's another death at the beginning of both the book and the movie.
Right.
And that's the reason he has to leave Kansas City, is he is out with his buddies and they hit somebody and kill them. And then he hightails it out of town to go to Chicago, where he becomes a bellhop. And in this movie, they just pick up with him having met his uncle and having been a bellhop and going off to the Adirondacks or wherever this is. And so if you don't know that he's already fled from a murder, you might think, oh, gee, this is just a, you know, a little blip in his background. But no, he's already been involved in a, you know, an accidental death or deliberate death or however you want to paint it. So I kind of think lopping that off leaves something on the cutting room floor. I think some reference to that might have been helpful.
The original movie also explains his relationship with his mother, who is apparently, they're both a mother and a father existent in the original movie, where they're both street missionaries. Yeah. And he is has gotten this job as a bellhop, and he is convinced to go off with his friends, and they hit and kill this child, and he has to go off to Kansas City, and there's a little outlay of Kansas City rather, and there's a scene of his mother basically praying for his eternal soul, mm-hmm. and then later on in the movie, at the end, in the scene that becomes Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift's scene in The Place in the Sun, it's his mother who's there with him at the time of his death, and I think they're trying to talk about in the original movie, they're trying to talk more about this sort of weird childhood he had as the child of missionaries, whereas in A Place in the Sun, even though they mention his mother, they're basically saying he's a working class kid, he's not like us. But in the original, it's about the sort of missionary upbringing and how I guess he's gone wrong.
No, Mickey, do you remember, Mickey, when you read the book, from what I had been reading about the book, which I haven't read, that the themes were about the impossibility of the American dream, that you can't do this jump from poverty to the rich world, and also that there was a theme in the book about the way that his religious fundamentalist upbringing really warped him. And from what I read,
yes,
these themes disappeared from both movies. And
yeah, so in this movie, his mother's just, you know, a Salvation Army, a little bit odd kind of person. And I'm trying to remember when Guys and Dolls was on Broadway, but Guys and Dolls, you know, takes place partly in a mission in New York, where they're singing and dancing, basically. But in the book, there's quite a lot of exposition about that. And it's definitely pictured as, not only is he fleeing the car crash, he's fleeing this background. And in this movie, it's just a little bit of an inconvenience and eccentricity.
Yeah, they really underdevelop that aspect of his character. But I like the fact that, like, he's not fleeing from a murder. He's not a mustache twirling cad. I think it kind of makes him worse in a way if he's just this ordinary mumbly Joe who just wants something that he can't have or thinks he can't have. I think that makes him more pathetic and more compellingly awful.
Well, especially since they set him up at the beginning, as we discussed, with these people who will not let him into their society because of his background, not because they know him. They've never met him before, except for the uncle. All they know about him is his tweed suit, but they've already decided before he even enters the living room, the parlor, pardon me, it's probably not a living room because it's a mansion, but they've already decided they're not going to take him up socially. They're not going to give him an important position in the factory. They're just going to tolerate him and do as little as they can for him as possible. And so your sympathies are with him, and they continue to be with him, as we discussed, because of the Shelley Winters character's sort of attitude and sort of whininess and all of that, and because you like to see Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor together. And once I thought about it later, like while I was watching the movie, I was a little, I was fine with my sympathies mostly being with George. And then later on, I thought, wow, do I really feel some sort of sympathy for this guy who, despite the fact that he was done wrong by his relatives, does end up, you know, killing his girlfriend who's pregnant and going off or attempting to go off with the beautiful woman he's incredibly attracted to.
So there's a flaw, you know, social flaw, let me just say, in some of this, because extra men, you know, sometimes you want young men who are presentable, who can dance, who can just show up, be ushers, that sort of thing. And we've had World War II, and guys got killed, and guys did not come home from the war, and guys came home maimed from the war. And so someone, you know, with all four limbs, who's good looking, who is interested in being part of your social group, that would have been somebody that you would mentor. And that's what I think in this case, had they decided, you know, George is okay, and let's take him in a little earlier in the movie without Angela having fallen in love with him, that it could have been more striking that they've taken him in and then Shelley Winters is holding him back. And that's, you know, one scene. It could have just taken one scene, but I think that would have even heightened the tension a little bit more.
I do really like the set design in this movie and the way that it becomes a reflection of the character's inner thoughts. I mean, when Montgomery Clift calls his mom in the mission, there is literally a sign behind her: "Have you called your mother today?" when he's in his apartment and he's obsessed with Angela, there's the blinking neon light of a Vickers factory in the background. Yeah. Yes,
on the nose, but still.
There's the painting of Ophelia drowned on the wall behind him when he realizes he's going to drown. There's subtle. The pictures of the bathing beauty overhead. Oh, it's not subtle at all, but it's really interesting. The
make your
the
holiday death's beauties. Holiday too.
Yeah. Well, that's part of, yes, that might have been like they were trying to harken back to Theodore Dreiser, because when I understand, he put everything was a symbol. Every spare item in his book symbolized something.
So again, back to the original movie. First of all, it's directed by Joseph von Sternberg, who at that time and subsequently was mostly known for directing all of Marlene Dietrich's early movies, both in Germany and in the U.S. And this is, I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't read it, because I don't look at that and go, that's Sternberg's style, because it's really not. There is so much symbolism in the movie, and it hits you in the head. It's not even really symbolism. It's just on the note. Like, there are intertitles because it's 1931 and they're still using intertitles to segue between one scene to the other. And all of them are over water. There are so many scenes of both incidental water and people in water. The first scene of the movie, but long before Sylvia Sidney character drowns, he's out on a boat with that character, and he takes boat rides with Angela. There's so much water. Oh my God, I think we're supposed to notice. And it's a little too much in the von Sternberg movie, although you could argue, you know, it's stylistic and it's hitting you in the head and it's 1931. I don't know. I thought it was a little much, probably because I had just watched this movie and I was watched The Place in the Sun, and I was just feeling like it was not as subtle as I wished it to be.
I have a little bit of trivia. We were talking about World War II and it not showing up in the movie, but there are two... there are two connections between this movie and Germany. And one of them, remember when they all get in the, Montgomery Clift and Liz Taylor are trying to be alone, and all their buddies jump into their speedboat and they go speeding around the lake, and there's all these other boats. And I guess the sound editors didn't think that the sound was good enough, and they wanted to heighten the kind of sense of danger. So they brought in sounds of German dive bombers.
Oh, no.
Wow.
And into that scene. And the second German reference is they didn't want to name this movie an American tragedy, because the first movie, which I think came out in 31 or so, didn't do very well. And they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So they were sitting around thinking of, what are we going to call this movie? And one of them said, you know, I was thinking about Kaiser Wilhelm, as you do, and how Kaiser Wilhelm...
Aren't we all thinking about Kaiser Wilhelm?
Is that like thinking about the Roman Empire or something different?
Yeah, and how Kaiser Wilhelm, before World War II, he talked about Germany's role in the world, and that Germany wanted to have its place in the sun. And that's where the title came from.
That's where the title came from.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting.
I do love that speedboat scene, the way that the sound washes over the radio as it's, you know, the radio and the speedboats are sort of fighting to see which one is going to break through. It's so clever and so effective at building the sense of dread.
I like it a lot.
Yeah.
I also love the sound of a loon. Apparently, like, the cry of a loon is supposed to prophesy that someone's going to die.
Oh.
I think I heard that somewhere. I promise that's not from like the IMDb trivia, but I do like how it comes back in the courtroom at a key moment. Okay. They layer that sound in.
Apparently, it's a musical theme of Loon Lake, and it's either an oboe or a flute, and it shows up first. When we first meet Shelley Winters.
So I want to talk a little bit about Liz and Monty, and not them. Well, we'll get to them as people and actors, but just what I find interesting about their relationship and the fact that they're instantly smitten with each other. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she's his big chance, right? So we understand that. We understand he's ambitious, but they go to great pains in the movie of making it clear that this is a complete physical attraction. This is not just, oh, you're pretty, and oh, you're intriguing and roguishly handsome. they're very, very sexually attracted to each other. And that is both the chemistry of the actors and also what I was talking about before about how George Stevens, that's what he wanted. And those are the kind of pages he wrote. It was based on the chemistry of the two performers because they had gotten to know each other and were very, very good friends by this point. Elizabeth Taylor was pretty much in love with Clift. Clift was gay or bisexual and was not going to have a physical relationship with her, but they were very, very close. And she, at the age of 19, was extremely in love with him. But that's interesting because it does add a little bit of a dynamic to just this, you know, am I going to choose the right thing or am I going to choose the money and the ambition that I want? Is you've added the dimension of I'm obviously attracted to Shelley Winters because I left the radio on that night. But he's also then moved on to be very attracted to Angela, which is, you know, that's the way people are. They can be attracted to multiple people. But again, it's not something that you see in movies of that era. I always think it's interesting that the code is very literal about things like, can you say the word abortion or can you imply it or how can you say it? There's some notes that I read that there were, I can't call to mind the exact dialogue, but it was tweaked slightly so that everybody knows that they're talking about abortion, but they never say abortion clearly. And that the Breen office had very specific opinions. But what the code never really gets is how character development or how actions of characters in relation to one another or relation to previous relationships that the characters have had can just as easily subvert those conservative 50s norms that they're trying to propagate.
I thought Liz Taylor was 17 when this was filmed.
I don't think she was married yet.
No, she was not.
To Nicky Hilton. Nicky Hilton? Is that her first
Nicky
husband?
Hilton, yeah, that was the first husband. She married him while she was making Father of the Bride, which is her next movie.
Next movie, yeah.
It's confusing to me because I think she might have been 19 when it was released, but 17 when this was made. Because I read both as well. She's very young in either case. Yeah. She is by all accounts a virgin at this point.
Yeah, I never got a sexual relationship between them, and like I said, I never saw what she saw in him. I got what he saw in her. Like, she's the ideal, the symbol of all the status and the social aspirations that he wants and he feels has been denied him. And I mean, she's Elizabeth Taylor. She's gorgeous. And he's Montgomery Clift. He's gorgeous. But I never got like a sense of heat between them. They always seemed like reserved and proper. Like, she was the good girl who wasn't going to do that sort of thing. And he seemed to understand that. Even though she also like seems to make a habit of running from the cops when they're trying to give her speeding tickets, which is like, it's just, they might as well have driven past a billboard that said white privilege. Whereas Shelley Winters, you know, there's some heat there and I buy that. I buy the kind of earthiness. And I think I felt like that was a deliberate contrast. You know, Shelley Winters is the earthy, the sensual one, you know, Angela Vickers is the elevated, the high-minded one, but it's just me, maybe.
I agree with you. I felt like the kissing scene between Montgomery Clift and Shelley Winters, it was earthier. You could see him have kind of a breathlessness and that I didn't catch that when he was kissing Liz Taylor. It just seemed more elegant, but less passionate. You know, less earthy.
You can shove the camera real close to your stars all you want, and it can only do so much in that regard.
Well, the other thing that I found interesting and also puzzling about her character was, you know, the things that she's throwing at him when, you know, he's shooting pool by himself and she looks in the door and goes, oh, wow. And then she's asking him if he's blue, which is interesting. I mean, why would she care if he's blue? And then the whole tell mama all things.
Where did that come
from? Why does she want to be maternal?
From Charles Stevens, that's where it came
from. I mean,
from.
Is there something, does she not get any, you know, comfort from her parents or her siblings? I mean, what is the reason why she, you know, she's gorgeous and he's gorgeous. And why is she trying to be maternal-ish? You know, it's almost a little Oedipus-y.
There's a book
Oedipus-y,
called
Oedipus-y, I'm sorry. But you know what I'm Oedipus-like.
I did not enjoy that James Bond movie at all.
I hated that one.
There's a book called Elizabeth and Monty that I read and reread the chapters about their meeting and A Place in the Sun for our conversation tonight. And it addresses that. And this is all George Stevens. This is where I was talking about him writing script pages and giving them the day of. What he perceived between Taylor and Clift is this incredible chemistry, but also that Elizabeth Taylor, even at her young age, and I'm quoting the book, I'm not saying that I necessarily saw it, was that she had a maternal instinct and that she had a maternal relationship, not completely maternal with Clift, but that there was some aspect of a maternal relationship in the way that she interacted with him. Hmm. And so Stevens wrote that line and Elizabeth Taylor balked at it. She's like, what, why am I, why, what? And he
good
said, no,
instincts,
just do it.
Liz.
we don't get it either.
It's like, hi, I've got mommy issues like from here to Cincinnati and back. And she's like, oh, man, I am all in. Sign me up.
I mean, I still feel like there's an attraction between them, but I agree with you about the line. I was like, I don't know. And that, yeah, that's a famous, one of the two most famous scenes from this movie, probably. And it's this extreme close-up, which was also Stevens doing it on purpose. And it's especially if you think about, well, I mean, I'm watching it on a mid-sized television, but imagining watching it on a giant screen from 1951, and it just seems like it would be a little too much, or it's trying a little too hard.
I don't know. I mean, there's something. It's very erotic, I guess you could say, maternal and erotic at the same time. Yeah. And her dress.
That's a thing.
And her dress is beautiful. you can't deny the clothes.
And definitely, if she takes him up and he marries her. Yeah. There's a way in which he will be taken care of. He will not only be her husband, but he will be part of this family, this society, and he'll never want for anything. And whether she's offering that to him specifically or whether that's just the way he takes it, because I feel like that's part of his attraction to the lifestyle that she represents. You could some weird Oedipal issues perhaps going on there. I don't know.
Thank God we have Raymond Byrd there to take us away from all the Oedipal impulses and not think about sex at all.
fair point. But yeah, I think the universe is just unbalanced because you're like, no, Raymond Burr, what are you doing at the prosecutor's table? That is the wrong side of the courtroom, man.
Well, and especially because there's a shot very early after we get to the courtroom where the angle is very much a Perry Mason angle. It's exactly the Perry Mason angle where the judge, you're looking down from the judge's bench and Perry Mason is kind of looking up. And it's like, that's the same shot. Freaking me out. Apparently, Gail Patrick, who was a former film actress, she was in My Man Godfrey and became a film producer in the 50s. She had married somebody who was also a film producer, but she was a very active film producer as well. She saw Raymond Burr in this movie, and that's why he came to her mind when she was putting Perry Mason together. So there is a direct connection. Also, and this one is just weird, and I had no idea till I actually watched the movie today. In 1931's An American Tragedy, the character Perry Mason plays in A Place in the Sun is named Mason.
So you think it was his subtle and refined performance that got him Perry Mason?
Oh. I don't know.
I mean, but he's supposed to be a blunt instrument in these movies. Right. Like the DA is always like just this rabid dog of justice, and so I bought that.
But he's got the cane and the glasses. Well, I want to mention something else. Before he shows up, we see Montgomery Clift wandering through the forest trying to escape. And he runs into this older man with a beard who's standing there looking very stern. And I thought for a minute I was in like a different movie. It was the sheriff. And I was like, I want to see more of this guy. And then there's Raymond Burr. I'm like, oh, God.
That scene with the sheriff is so inexplicably chilling. Like the light changes. It's like a natural, it's naturalistic light in a film that's got almost nothing but studio lighting. And it feels like something out of a nightmare. It's like, is this the devil? Has he come to the crossroads? It was like, you know, this one guy who hasn't really appeared much for the rest of the movie suddenly carries the whole weight of destiny on his shoulders. He's like, I've caught up with you. You're done, son.
I do want to mention that there is a I didn't even notice her. Well, I know that there's a factory co-worker that testifies, and she has kind of a round face. And I thought, she looks familiar. And it's Kathleen Freeman, who lived until 2001, was in Full Monty, the stage show, and was in a whole bunch of TV shows and movies. And she was the acting coach in Singing in the Rain. She's
Round Tones. Round the Rocks, the Rugged Rascal, okay. Rue, yes. Or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. And the other, And the other interesting performer I noticed that was the Eastman's, George Eastman's mother. She doesn't do a whole lot, but her name is Ann Revere. And she actually, right around, I think, when this was being made, she got tied up in the blacklist. And I read something that I haven't been able to confirm anywhere else, but someone had said that her role was cut down in this movie because of
this blacklist
connection. I don't know if that's true, but
I can see that for all the times when she started talking to George about the virtues of international communism.
Hey, when the communism gets on my...
And it says that this was her last movie that she did for 20 years. And she plays the character very old, but I think she was only, looking here, she was only like 44 at the time, just about 14 years older than Montgomery Clift.
I'll also mention Paul Frees, who plays the Reverend in the jail at the end. He's most well known as a voice actor and radio and animated cartoon. You've in every Hanna-Barbera cartoon of the 60s and 70s, you would have heard Paul Frees as either the announcer or the villain or somebody. So I heard that voice. I was looking at my phone briefly, and then I heard, that's Paul Frees. And I looked up, and he was, that's what Paul Frees looks like. And now I know.
And another, but the other trivia, apparently George Stevens, in the late 60s, they were going to put this movie on TV and with commercials. And he sued and says, I control this movie and you can't mess it up by, having a commercial for dishwasher soap, between these incredible scenes. And it went to court and he lost. And that's why
I'm just imagining now, after the drowning scene, they cut to commercial. When you're on the water, use Safeco Life Preservers. Safeco,
Life
you'll
Boy.
Never drown.
Life Boy.
In 1966, A Place in the Sun was sold to NBC, not MSNBC, was sold to NBC to be broadcast on TV. And he filed a lawsuit against NBC and Paramount. And he was insisting that his movie be presented exactly the way he shot it. And this is from the commentary. I think this was his son talking. He said that the splicing in of color commercials for cigarettes and deodorants into the print of his film was a violation of his contract. But the judge ruled that as long as it did not diminish the effect of his film, then it was not a contract violation.
But why this movie and not Giant or any other movie? I read that as well, and I was like, I don't have time to understand why A Place in the Sun is more special than Giant or anything else that might be on TV. Now, A Place in the Sun at a 2-hour running time was probably more likely to be screened on TV in the 60s than Giant, which is, 3 hours long, something like that. But he made plenty of other movies that might have had the same issues. I don't know. Maybe it was because it won him an Oscar and it was acclaimed or something. I'm not sure.
Actually, George Stevens Jr. is still alive. I think he's well over
it.
For now.
90, I think, isn't he?
He's 91.
Randy, you're jinxing it, man. Don't do it.
I did check to see
cut
if anybody...
Cut that part out.
I did check to see if anybody involved with this movie was still alive, and no. I even checked the kid that was camping, and
he's a teenager though. He's got to be dead.
He's dead.
I don't know.
He is dead, so.
I'm sorry, young man. Whoever you are,
he's no longer with us. But what did George? I don't know what George Stevens. I just pulled up his Wikipedia page. What he's done. His career,
I mean, George Stevens Jr. basically founded the American Film Institute and the Kennedy Center Honors was a big part of that. I mean, George Stevens Jr. is a real guy. He also does a lot to promote his father's legacy, but he has had quite the career as a producer and behind the scenes sort of guy in his own right.
Yeah, yeah. But what's he done for us lately?
Right?
Well,
he actually
we'll
published
see.
A book not long ago. Yes, we will see. We'll talk about that later.
So I need to shout out the luau. So I'll tell you something. You know, it made total sense to me because people went to Hawaii and they would come home and have luau parties. And my parents had a luau party after they got back from Hawaii. In fact, I was just sorting through some clothes this weekend and I found two authentic Hawaiian shirts from my father that my father bought when he was in Hawaii. So it seems a little bit out of left field, but someone in that group went to Hawaii and decided, well, we're all going to come back and eat things out of pineapples and have flaming food. So it would have probably made sense to people watching the movie at the time. Oh, yeah, we'll have a luau party. But people actually did have luau parties.
Doesn't that seem more middle class than upper middle class? Or
well,
upper,
maybe
upper class?
At that point in time, that's who could afford to go to Hawaii. Were upper class people, because they would have, they probably would not have flown. They would have taken liners from Long Beach, so it would have been quite a luxurious vacation. Especially since this group, we think, are in upstate New York. We think this is maybe the Adirondacks, and so,
yeah, I think so.
To get to Hawaii would have been quite a schlep.
So let's see, we talked about Edith Head's clothes, specifically the two Elizabeth Taylor dresses. The white dress apparently had quite the impact on prom dresses for the entirety of the decade of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So a lot of girls wore that dress. I hope Edith Head got some royalties. Probably not. It was probably just some knockoffs. But even so, that's how this movie had its impact on some part of culture.
No, it's interesting because she had the dress, the tulle, you know, the strapless tulle dresses. Yeah. And then a lot of her other clothes, when she was driving in the convertible, I think she had a headscarf on, were not particularly memorable. And then at the very end of the movie, when she comes to see him before he's taken off to the chair, although we never see that in this movie, and we do see it in the other movie. And it's very explicit in the book that he fries. So, but she's dressed down, obviously, as one would be to go to prison.
That whole scene at the death house, but both when he's talking to the reverend and then eventually when she comes to see him right before he dies, that is actually reminiscent to me of what they did in 30s movies. They didn't necessarily show it, although there are a couple of notable exceptions where you might not have seen it, but you certainly heard it. But it's a very, in 30s movies, it's usually crime dramas where it's very much how we have this person who has been a criminal through the whole movie, but now he's in the final throes of his life and he's offered the opportunity to repent or get absolution or something like that. And he either goes to the chair bravely and stoically or as a screaming coward or whatever. And you don't really see that sort of death house scene once you get to movies of the 50s. There are a couple of exceptions, but especially in a movie that's not, you know, generally speaking, a crime movie, it's kind of interesting that they went that route. I think it's a good choice, actually, but especially I do like the scene where she comes to see him, but it just seemed really out of place, I guess.
Speaking of clothes, did you guys notice that when he's walking to the electric chair, one cuff of his pants is hanging down, kind of dragging behind him. And that is actually something they do because they have to roll up the pant leg to attach the electrode when you electrocute somebody. So that looked like a little bit of realism in there.
I really like the ambiguity that they preserve, how the central event of the film takes place at a distance. You don't really know what happened until that last scene in the jail cell when it turns out that he did and did not murder her and that he didn't push her into the water, but he didn't try to save her either. I really like that. I thought that was one of the strongest aspects of the film.
You know, I also was thinking that could have been manslaughter instead of first degree murder. because she's we think so. This is just like Rebecca. So in the book of Rebecca, he does kill her. So Max de Winter actually does kill her.
Oh, really?
Yes. In the movie,
that makes sense.
She slips and hits her head.
Right.
Yeah. So the movie gives you the ambiguity that she slipped and it was an accident, but in the book, he killed her. And so in the in this situation, because we don't see, you know, Shelley Winters just sort of tumble, she gets up. It's not like he pushes her into the water. She stands up, she loses her balance and falls into the water. Now, of course, he commits the sin of not trying to save her or not trying to get her out of the water or whatever. But he could have gotten off on second degree or manslaughter, which probably would not have been the electric chair. And
he also doesn't report to the authorities that she's
right. Yeah. Died. I mean, he's it's pretty clear that, you know, yeah. Like the priest says, well, in your heart, you committed murder, you know. But there was enough ambiguity. So if he had really good lawyers and the Eastmans were willing to put up the money, they probably could have gotten him off of death row. You know, that was sort of my reading of it, that, that it, there was enough wiggle room that it didn't have, he didn't have to go to the chair, but he ended up going to the chair.
Kind of reminds me of Betty Davis and the Little Foxes.
Herbert Marshall. Yeah.
Yeah. And just a few seconds where she's not acting and not doing anything. And then suddenly she's like, oh my gosh, everybody come help. But it's just that.
I played that scene once in high school. It was so much fun.
Really?
Ooh.
I did. I was Regina.
Wow. And,
yeah. The person who was my, what's his name? Horace? What's Leo? No. The guy she lets die. Anyway, it was somebody I had a really big crush on. It was a weird situation.
Oh, no. And you killed him. Well, you got.
I let Jeff Meyer die.
You manslaughtered him, so it's okay.
So I have a long history of this, apparently.
Yeah, I got to say though, by this same logic, you know, you didn't push him into the water; you just let them drown. But it's not really totally murder. That means that leave her to heaven. You know, Ellen is not fully culpable.
Oh yeah,
so right. I kind of got to be team first degree murder on this one, if only for Ellen's sake.
We had to talk about leave her to heaven. If more waterborne hijinks. Well, friends, anything else on A Place in the Sun?
Shelley, you are going to avoid water from now on, aren't you?
Of course. No water.
I know there's a lake.
She's not even going to drink it.
There's like, what, Lake Travis where you live? What's it called?
Yep.
We have Lake Travis. We have Lady Bird Lake. We have multiple
don't
lakes.
Don't go there.
Don't go there. Yeah.
Well, don't go there with Montgomery Cliff, okay?
Oh, okay. Well, that's
that one should be fairly easy to accomplish.
Yes. Well, friends, thanks so much for being here to talk about A Place in the Sun. We will be back next week with our final episode of the spring season, where we'll talk about a wonderful pre-code from 1933 called Employee's Entrance. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. We are going to have such a good
time. Begging you, listeners, watch this movie. You are not prepared. It is great.
If you want to keep up with this show, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can subscribe. You can write to us at lts@theincomparable.com or find us on the socials at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Bye now.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. Theincomparable.com/members.